I'm here talking to Phil Long. I'm actually in his office at MIT, which is a very nice privilege. And we're just chatting a few moments about technology. So can you just give your brief one-sentence bio, Phil?
Sure. I'm the associate director in a new office at MIT called the Office of Educational Innovation and Technology. And we're responsible for working with faculty to help identify emerging R&D activities that might actually be useful in teaching and learning at the Institute.
And that's perfect, because I wanted to chat with you about emerging technologies. You're part of the Horizon Project again, and we're just starting up our process of looking at emerging technologies. And wondering if you can sort of encapsulate, you know, how you go about that process of identifying what speaks to you as emerging, or how does that happen?
Well, after sacrificing several chickens and boiling frogs and such and making the cauldron, the first phase, I think, for all of us that participate in this is to sort of set aside one's assumptions and relook at all of those little bookmarks that you've made as you found something interesting on the web and popped them into your delicious list, and dust those off and rethink them in the light of the goals and objectives of the Horizon Project, which is intended to look at potential emerging technologies that can impact teaching, learning, and the creative arts, but to do so from different points of view. So from activities that it might be emerging from entertainment or corporate or commercial sources, from other venues within higher ed, of course, but also from research labs and entertainment industries. So the first thing is to sort of relook at those kinds of things and try to remember what it was that captured your attention and interpret that in terms of the Horizon's goals. And the second, I think, is to challenge one's assumptions, because often we dismiss things as being, you know, not very exciting or relevant, what have you. But maybe in second thought, what you didn't think was exciting or relevant on the one hand is, in fact, important. And so a goal of the Horizon Project is also to look at things that ought to be more widely disseminated, sort of as ubiquitous air that all institutions should be taking advantage of. And there is certainly a tendency coming from this institution at MIT to kind of naturally focus on the things that are several years out and in the more exotic unusual space of interesting technologies, but there are lots of things that that ought to be just present in as part of the underlying baseline of one's work, and both at MIT and elsewhere, which we need to make sure that the Horizon Report reviews and captures.
Right, and I was going to ask. I mean, I would think, you know, here at MIT, you'd be plugged into so many things. Does this report get some circulation around here?
Absolutely. In fact, we present it to the what's called Dean's Council at MIT, and we use it in meetings with the different schools. So, for example, the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, which we refer to as SHAS, has a school council meeting, and the Horizon Report will be one of the things that we feature in a discussion of technologies that the folks in those disciplines ought to be thinking about. And there's another branch of this activity that I know the NMC has been spearheading, which is to look at this report in terms of specific subsets or groups within institutions, whether that's admissions or alumni or libraries or things, you know, groups that have a particular focus, and sort of channel the different things that are put together into the Horizon Report from the perspective of those audiences. And so that's something else that we're trying to do internally.
Mm-hmm. And on the theme of how, you know, organizations deal with this, I mean, we're talking about change, which might be disruptive. You know, the big question is, you know, how do organizations continue to, quote-unquote, you know, stay ahead, mm-hmm. or keep up with these? So are there things that we aren't doing that we should be doing better in terms of facing these changes? You know, how do you answer that question? How do we continually stay on this treadmill?
Well, the bottom line for most faculty, and I think it's true whether you're at an MIT or whether you're at a technical school or Ecor Community College or a state four-year, the limiting factor for almost anyone in this business is time. Mm-hmm. And so the first question is whether or not this particular activity and technology is going to do something to help you recapture that. Now, occasionally there are things that are, but not necessarily. The other, you know, so once you press that filter on it, the next question is, what are the things that that allow you to do things that you otherwise can't do? Do some editing on this.
Yeah, that's what Audacity's for. We're talking about recapturing time, and
right.
And then the next level.
And the next level is it a technology or a capability that allows you to do something that you otherwise haven't been able to do and wanted to do? So there may be, you know, for example, an opportunity that a visualization affords you that, yeah, it takes time to learn, but you just have never been able to get this point across in the way that you think you need to. For your students to really grok it. Mm. In which case, it's worth spending that time because there's a value proposition at the end that is unreachable otherwise. And then the third thing is that does it afford you something in terms of breadth of your experience and capability that might have value marginally or a little bit in its direct implementation or direct use, but has also additional values in terms of what it helps you think about in other correlated activities. And if you keep those sorts of things in mind, then I think it makes it a little bit easier to deal with the whipsaw of change that that we're all facing. And, you know, I guess to some extent, I'm sensitive to the perception of treading water and being unable to keep up. On the other hand, we choose our careers, and if you're going to be in higher education, and if you're going to be in the position of informing and shaping the next generation of students and leaders, I think you need to step up to the challenge.
This is the new status quo, then, right?
This is the new status quo, and you know they say that we'll all be in our productive lives in 8 or 10 different jobs. IBM has a statistic that shows that the doubling of information is going to occur by 2010 every 11 hours. So, you know, you can't be, if that's anywhere even close to accurate, you can't be content to convey a corpus of knowledge. What you can be and should be focusing on is conveying a way of thinking. Mm. And there are new tools emerging all the time that help us help us do just that.
All right, and this may be putting you on the spot because we're just starting with the Horizon process, but you know, we've had over the last few years, you know, mobile phones, mobile technology has been kind of a continued theme, and for good reasons. Mm-hmm. It's continuing to evolve, and same way some of the sort of, you know, the social networking, it was sort of last year it was user-generated content. Mm-hmm. And educational games have, you know, been on the horizon for a while. Any interesting dark horses or that you're thinking that you might throw into the bin this year?
Well, I think we're going to start to see some interesting technologies that that connect biophysical processes to conscious levels of activity. So in one extreme, it might be instrumentation on your body that informs the reactions and expressions of your avatar in Second Life or whatever the new version of Second Life is in 2 or 3 years, so that if you're feeling anxious and or bored in your physical presence in real life, that will be in fact conveyed to your avatar as well, or the opposite.
Oh, wow.
Where you can be intentionally deceptive. And if you're feeling anxious and such in your real life, then your avatar is incredibly laid back and calm and collected. So I think there's going to be some interesting intersections between real and virtual existence that we're going to have to start paying attention to. Now, how that relates to educational applications and such remains to be seen, but I could certainly see it relevant to business negotiations or other kinds of interactions in virtual space that, as well as in physical space, that that are going to be useful in social engagements. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I'm curious about. I also think that there is increasingly, essentially, what I would call data mashups that are becoming much more interesting. The opportunities to combine large corpuses of data from various locations and look at them in different ways. That's things like that have been around for a bit. I'm thinking of the faceted browsing tools and such from projects like the Simile project here at MIT. But I think that they're starting to emerge in a more widespread fashion and find new uses as a consequence of that visibility.
And then combine with some of the new visualization tools.
Yeah. And right, exactly. And you can start to see, you know, the whole notion. Interestingly, I think that creativity and innovation occurs at edges. And so when tools sort of are underground and in a particular discipline space for a while, they mature a bit, and then they start to become more widely visible, perhaps a slightly easier to use without the depth of knowledge that they originally required, and now they act as catalysts. And I think there are some of those that are coming from the data mining in spaces that might be in that category.
Mm-hmm. And just for the last piece, shift to talk about, you know, virtual worlds. You know, this has been the year for Second Life. I mean, and to some, there's too much Second Life going on. For some, not enough.
Right.
But
it's... You get the ghetto life comment, right?
It's really exploded. And I'm enjoying asking people, you know, why they think it's happening and sort of, you know, where you think we're going with it. Because we're at somewhat of an experimentation stage, and MIT is doing some work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you see as the next step for virtual worlds?
Well, I think there's two emerging areas that are going to need attention if this is going to retain interest amongst the wider group. The first is that that there needs to be some degree of interoperability amongst aspects of these different worlds. You know, right now they're kind of like the days of early local area networks, and you are in one network, you have your own accountant and file storage and such, and as you go to another part of a building, you get your own, a different LAN, and you've got a different one there. And that's true of virtual worlds today. But just as we recognize and value having certain degree of commonality and ubiquity across spaces in our network life, I think that's true in the virtual spaces. And so there has to be something that starts to identify what is it to be identified, and how do you present that across different interfaces to different worlds. So that's one thing. And the second, I think, is one of the reasons virtual worlds are so attractive is that they allow for, encourage, and support interaction across space and time in very natural ways, and in the process, they bring forward the secondary cues that are associated with the spaces that are constructed, and by thoughtful design of those spaces, we can intentionally project what we would like to have as interaction environments. And so as our students are more globally engaged in such, I think you're going to see virtual worlds as a mechanism by which students from one institution that are working in a location remote from that institution stay connected with it. And I think you're going to find that rather than being a mechanism for distance learning, it will be, and in fact, it's just the opposite in some sense. It'll turn that on its head and say you'll have these disparate students doing things in far-flung parts of the world, and it's through virtual spaces that you end up connecting back to the zip code they came from.
Hmm. That's interesting. And lastly, I mean, can you talk a little bit about, you know, MIT's direction now in Second Life?
Yeah, well, there's two or three sets of activities going on at the moment. There is the Media Lab, which is putting together a new center for virtual life. It's trying to look you know, 10 years out, as the Media Lab is intent on doing. And their focus is to explore the intersection between physical life, reality, and virtual life, and it doing so under the with the assumption that you are continuously in both realities simultaneously. So how does it? What is life like if in on a 24-hour day you have a virtual and a real presence, and you have selective interactions ongoing with both of those?
So you never log off.
So you're never logged off. Your avatar is there while when you're asleep, and there is potentially biofeedback between your body and your secondary virtual existence, or vice versa, feedback from your virtual existence that informs your body. And so what are the devices that are needed to be in place in order to enable that? What's the desirability for having that kind of existence? How can you leverage it? So that's one set of activities that are going on that Cynthia Brazil and the Media Lab is leading up. And in the rest of the Institute, we're looking at it from our perspective of global MIT and how does the far-flung programs that MIT has with different colleagues and organizations around the world take advantage of the space. And I think the last area is that we are interested in the actual underlying technologies and some of the things like identity management and extracting content from one environment and moving it into another. So we would be we plan on doing some work across multiple virtual worlds and exploring what options are there and what sorts of interoperability standards need to emerge.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.